And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, you know, we focused a lot on this team's offensive shortcomings this year, but, you know, to their credit, they have been very adept at hitting into double plays.
The last couple of nights against the Giants, it's been their peak of the season in hitting into double plays. They hit into five the other night, including multiple ones that were, you know, not ground ball double plays, but bad reads on the bases. That's, you know, they've done that a bit more lately, which I think you get the sense like that is what happens when a team is pressing to score runs. You're trying to get better reads off the bat, and you get bad reads off the bat. Sometimes when you do that, you try to be a little bit too aggressive, thinking that a ball is going to drop in when it's not. So they've had two instances I can remember, because it was J.D. Davis in L.A. and it was Javi Baez the other night, that like they were rounding third when the ball was caught and there was no chance of getting back. It was just kind of like, oh, right, yeah, they can throw me out now. So I think we've seen some evidence of the Mets' prolonged struggles offensively, kind of exacerbating themselves when the team tries to do a little too much.
Yeah, they are the only fifth in the league. You would think it would be a little bit better in times grounded into double play this year, but consider that the top three teams, the Nationals, Reds, and Padres, are all teams that are in the upper echelon of the National League and on-base percentage, which the Mets are definitely not. They are punching above their weight when it comes to grounding into double plays. But if we look at this seriously, and I, again, like last week when we spoke, I was optimistic, and I realized there's a lot of season left, and, you know, you made the point, and everyone makes the point that Mets fans know better than everyone how quickly a season can turn around and how quickly a 7.5-game lead could evaporate. But I think this team is cooked. I don't think there's a way they can climb back into it.
Yeah, it's very hard to see how they could get themselves back into it. You know, they've got these next 15 games against the Marlins and Nationals and Marlins, in that order. They play Washington, Miami, and they have to do something very good against those. You know, I would say probably like 12-3 at minimum. And then, you know, the Braves schedule is more difficult now, at least the next week. They've got I think they host the Giants and then they go to L.A. They've also got to go to San Francisco still this season, although that might be at a time of the year when, you know, depending on the NL West race, the Giants might not be pushing quite as hard at that point. So, you know, there's a little bit of hope schedule-wise from the Mets. But, you know, after this 15-game stretch, their schedule gets significantly more difficult again with series against the Yankees and the Cardinals and the Brewers and the Red Sox and the Braves. I think after this 15-game stretch, they've only got one more series against a team under 500, and that's Miami the last week of the season. So, they've got to go like 12-3, hope the Braves stumble and play 500 ball over the next 2 weeks, in which case, okay, then you're back within two or three games, and you've got a shot. But they just got to play better than we've seen. And there's a lot of, like, you know, what is the problem? And I think it really comes, like, you look at Wednesday's game, and Pete Alonso came up twice with the bases loaded, and there were four fastballs down the middle that he fouled off. And I don't want to put this on Alonso. He's been their best hitter in the second half of the season. He's the only guy who supplied runs for them on Thursday. But like, that is symptomatic. That is a symbol of what's gone wrong for this team, is they've had opportunities. It's not like pitchers haven't thrown them mistakes over the course of this season, the entire season of offensive woes for them. And they're just they're fouling them off, they're missing them, they're taking them. They're just not putting those mistakes into play with authority the way we're used to with these guys in their track record. You look at, like, I was looking at the batting averages of the starting lineups this past series from San Francisco and New York. Batting averages aren't that different. You know, no one on the Giants is hitting 330 or anything like that. The real difference is in the slugging percentages. You know, the Mets have just not slugged at all in August, really. They had three extra base hits in an inning last night on Thursday night, and that was the most they'd had in a long time. That was more than they'd had in the series up to that point. And, you know, a guy like Dominic Smith has something like 250 more plate appearances this year than last year, and he still has fewer extra base hits. It's just a team that hasn't slugged the way you thought, not just in home runs, but in doubles as well. And that makes them string together hits to score runs, and it's hard to do that. And they're not, you know, they're not a good enough contact team to do that either.
It has been enormously frustrating, and it was, you know, what seemed like what was a frustrating team even when they were sitting in first place. If you go back through our archives, I think we'll show that for sure. But now that they have fallen apart, it has just become and you made the call a couple weeks ago, just sort of a lifeless team. Even and Javi Baez has brought a little bit of a spark, but not nearly a big enough spark. Francisco Lindor in his first couple games back, struggling anew. Alonso, I would say, you know, and you're right that those at bats are a good symbol of what has gone wrong for the Mets. He's the one guy I think you feel pretty good about, and Brendan Nimmo too moving forward. But a couple of big pieces. Well, a very big piece of the Mets' future and a potential piece of the Mets' future making their way back to the field. You had a story about Jacob deGrom ramping it back up to try to get back on the field this season. And Noah Syndergaard made a rehab outing. He is not throwing breaking balls this year, but he is back throwing into the mid-90s, not quite the Noah Syndergaard triple digits, but, you know, adrenaline certainly will make up some of that difference, and he is definitely still working his way back. What do the Mets hope to see, and what can they get out of DeGrom and Syndergaard in terms of, you know, knowledge for moving forward?
Yeah, it wasn't all bad news for the team this week so far. The DeGrom news was good. The Syndergaard news was, you know, it's good that he's pitching. It's weird that he's doing it without breaking balls. With DeGrom, you know, he's on the 60-day IL through at least September 13th. He's just playing catch now. The general rule, I think, in baseball is like the amount of time that you were shut down as a pitcher, that's how long it takes you to ramp back up. DeGrom was shut down for essentially 4 weeks. So if you think he takes 4 weeks to get ramped back up, that leaves him with maybe a start or two at the end of the year. The Mets could accelerate that process. They did with someone like Carlos Carrasco in the middle of the season. They have said that, you know, regardless of their competitive context, they think it's valuable to see DeGrom pitch in major league games this season. I think I would be surprised if this team is 10 games out with 3 weeks left, with 2.5 weeks left, and they decide, you know, Jacob DeGrom can pitch 3-4 innings. We're going to do that in a major league game rather than in a minor league game. You know, he's not fully stretched out, but we're going to see him in a major league game. I shouldn't say I'd be surprised. Wait. I think that would be weird if they did that, but they might, you know, right, given what I thought it was weird that they did that with Carrasco earlier in the year. I argued against it. So I think they want to see where DeGrom is at. They, you know, in their minds, in the Mets' minds, he is a healthy pitcher at this point. That the inflammation in his elbow has cleared up. They're treating this like, you know, like, why shouldn't he pitch if he is healthy, even though he's had all of the issues earlier this year? I think there's a point to that. You know, this isn't like the NBA where you just shut a guy down because, oh, like, you know, we're out of it. We're gonna try to get good draft position. Like, there's no need for him to play the last month of the season. You don't see that in baseball to the same extent. And, you know, you don't see, like, teams that are out, like the Orioles don't just shut down John Means because they're out of it to save his arm. So, you know, they want to see where DeGrom is at. They want to get a sense of what he can be, what his offseason plan is, and what he can be going into next year. And, you know, want to see if he looks really good, then you can start thinking about extending him again because he's got the opt-out after 2022. So that's the plan with DeGrom. I'll let you comment on that before I dive into Syndergaard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it seems hard to expect, like, the Met fan part of me is like, what are you doing? What are you, like, why would you try to rush in any way, try to get this guy back, like, set any sort of timetable for a guy who is, you know, so good and will be, if healthy, such an important part of the team's success next year and possibly the year after that. Again, depending on how these contracts things, maybe further down the line than that. And so, you know, that instinct when you're sort of paranoid and waiting for everything that could go wrong to go wrong, you say, well, why? You know, but then I think the rational part of me says, you're right. Yeah, like that's not generally how baseball teams do it. You would like to know how he's, like, at some point he's going to need to pitch, and you'd rather assess it sooner than later, because if he does get back to a mound, if whether it's in a real game or a simulated game, and it goes awry, and, you know, he has to shut it down all over again, then that drastically changes the face of your offseason, I think. And we are sort of getting to the point of the year when the Mets need to start assessing, you know, how they're going to do things in the offseason. If you bring DeGrom back, you know, you think you follow all the correct protocols and you think you, you know, you've given them enough time to ramp up and something pops, or, you know, and knock on wood, you know, I don't want this to happen. But if it looks like, okay, like this is a bigger issue than we thought, then I don't think you can go about like trying to build a contender for 2022. I just don't think that's a reasonable approach. We've seen what has happened to the Mets, who were a contending team until DeGrom went out, right? And you can see the way the ripple effects that losing him have had on the club. So I want to like on spec say, oh, I hate this plan because the Mets made it. And yet, like, I can't really in good faith say, oh, this is a bad idea.
It's kind of like the opposite of, I think it was a Jeff Sullivan tweet that was like, or maybe it might have been Sam Miller, just like, love this trade for the Rays. Who'd they give up? Who'd they get?
Right.
And this is, hate this move by the Mets. What are they doing? Mm-hmm. I think it is a justified impulse for a Mets fan base to feel that way about how this team has handled injuries over the past, I don't know, two decades. But, you know, your point about the offseason is right. And it's if something were to happen to DeGrom, like this also gives you an idea of what his timeline is. You don't want to go into a situation where, you know, he has his normal offseason. He throws normally, like, you know, you go he did not experience this inflammation playing catch. Like he was fine doing that. It was only when he kind of went harder off of a mound that he felt it. And if he's going to feel something in there again, you kind of prefer it be now than at the start of spring training next year.
Absolutely.
Not just for your offseason plans, but for his availability. You know, if something happens now, then you can kind of dive deeper into, well, what is it? Because we didn't get a really good answer on that this first time. So I think that's kind of an animating impulse here for the Mets is if there is something wrong, we'd rather know about it a lot sooner than spring training of 2022. And then with Syndergaard, I do wonder how different the approach would be, because he's throwing fastball, two-seam, four-seam fastballs, as well as changeups, not throwing his slider. He said he was instructed by his two doctors, Dr. David Olchek and Dr. Neil Elitrash, guys who work with a ton of pitchers across the sport, to not throw his slider. They think that was the reason he had his setback earlier in the summer when he was shut down for an additional couple months. And Noah has extended that that mandate to his curveball, because he says the curveball kind of puts a similar amount of force on the surgically reconstructed elbow, so he doesn't quite feel comfortable with that yet. So, you know, even you know, that's a limited repertoire for him to come back with. Even if he were coming back mid-season, you could imagine the Mets with that repertoire thinking that maybe he should just be a reliever rather than a starter, you know, a 2.5 pitch pitcher basically, rather than a 4 pitch pitcher. I wonder how different the approach would be if he were under team control beyond this season, if he would really be coming back in this state. But I do think because he's a free agent, there is a little bit more of an urgency on his end to appear in Major League Baseball games again before he hits free agency. I do think this leads to there being a lot of questions. You know, the slider was his best pitch when he first came up, and in 2016 when he had his best season, his inconsistency with the slider in 2019 was the main reason he struggled for stretches of that summer. You know, he did. There were, you know, a lot of that month of June in 2019, he didn't really throw the slider. He threw it like 3 or 4 times a game for a month, and didn't pitch great. And he had his curveball then too. So it just seems like, you know, this guy going into free agency is going to get a handful of maybe 2 inning relief appearances to show that like the basics are there, but it does make it seem to me that it is likelier that he accepts like a qualifying offer from the Mets, because you know, for him to be a pitcher you're willing to give a significant deal to, you probably want to feel that he can throw his slider, his best secondary pitch, or his second best secondary pitch, and his curveball anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that it's a good point. I think you think they will offer him a qualifying offer.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are fans who are like, well, you know, you can get him for less than the, you know, 18.5, 19 million that a qualifying offer is going to be. But I think you look at the recent history of like pitchers who have just had Tommy John surgery get the 2-year deal worth like 15 or 16 million. Like Garrett Richards had Tommy John surgery in July of 2018, and that offseason, you know, before he's really, I don't even know if he was throwing by the time he signed with the Padres, he signed a 2-year, $15.5 million deal. So that's essentially $15.5 million for that second season, which would be his first time back from Tommy John. And, you know, I think Noah Syndergaard is a better pitcher than Garrett Richards. He's further along in his recovery at this point. So I would think if a team like San Diego were willing to give Richards $15.5 million for his comeback year, you would expect another team to be willing to give 18 or 19 to Syndergaard. So if you're the Mets, you offer him that. If he accepts it, that helps your rotation. You know, the Mets, again, there should be a team that's in a position to risk guys accepting the qualifying offer, even if they don't really want them. I think they would want Syndergaard to some extent. They shouldn't be in the situation that Oakland or Tampa Bay often find themselves in, of like turning down team options or not giving out qualifying offers to guys who then sign for similar amounts of money, like Marcus Semien or Liam Hendricks or Charlie Morton. So the Mets, this is a way, like if he accepts it, that's fine. If he turns it down, that's fine too. You can talk to him about something. You can still engage him if you want to re-sign him, and you get the draft pick if he signs elsewhere. So I think it's really a win-win for them.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm glad to hear you say it. I think that it's a worthwhile risk for a team that is purportedly going to be a big spender moving forward. And I find there's something like very, and again, this sort of goes against what I know to be true about baseball, which is that you'd rather have a good starter than even like an excellent reliever. And Syndergaard at his best was a very good starter. There is something tantalizing about the idea of that guy coming out of the bullpen. I do think he'll accept. My like hunch says he would accept a qualifying offer. It seems like he enjoys New York City. Like he seems like he's out and about a little bit, and it's a great environment for if you're looking for that pillow year, right? Like we talked about it with Michael Conforto, like perhaps he'd want to go to a better offensive environment and get himself a bigger contract. But I think with Syndergaard, like, well then, yeah, like of course you'd want to be pitching half your games in Citi Field if you're pitching for your next contract. And I kind of, there's like something that that's like very much appealing about like the notion of the bullpen door opening and 6'6", long blonde hair, giant, fireballing Noah Syndergaard emerging for like your eighth or your ninth. And again, like they don't have enough of a starting rotation to start thinking about this for 2022, but you can definitely envision like a sort of, with Syndergaard in there, you could think about this Mets bullpen with the pieces they already have, right? With Diaz and with Trevor May, we'll be back next year, right? Because he was 2 years.
Yes.
And with Seth Lugo, like that could be a really, really good bullpen. If you add a speed metal there in the eighth inning, or the ninth inning. Again, like I don't know that that's the right move. I just think that would be kind of cool.
You just want to see like the video board montage they would build for Noah Syndergaard in a leading situation.
You know, Immigrant Song, like the Led Zeppelin song, like and it's got like all Viking inspired lyrics. Like I think that would be how I would want that to go.
What would be your bullpen entrance song, and would it be different from your at bat song?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because I think your at bat song, you have like 10 seconds, right, and you want it to be instantly identifiable as yours, so that in a pinch hitting scenario, everybody, like, they play the music and everybody's like, ah, here comes Ted. And so like the Mike Piazza with like the Jimi Hendrix riff, I remember when he came back to Citi Field with the Padres I was at the first game, and like before his first at bat, it was like wow, down, wow, 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 and everybody knows it's Mike Piazza. Like that's cool. I remember even like Daniel Murphy a couple times, like pinch hitting, like you knew the Dropkick Murphy song was his jam. You knew he was coming up. Again, it was like a very identifiable from the start. Whereas you have a little more time for a build up with your closer song. You definitely want it to be inspiring from the get-go, but I think you don't need like that strong hook necessarily. So my bullpen music, and I've been pretty consistent with this, would be Keep Their Heads Ringing by Dr. Dre, like ding ding dong ding. If you listen to that song, it's like a throwdown, and I would love to have like just the whole everybody up and dancing. That would be me. I think there are a lot of different ways I think a closer could play it. I'm sort of like a fun, like I'm into like a good 90s West Coast party. And so that would be my approach. I think there's a strong case to be made. If you were like Syndergaard, and again, not better than the Immigrant Song, but for complete silence, like I think that if you could just say like my closer music is complete silence, and what we need is everybody in the crowd to shut up. And so like just the stadium, instead of like everybody going wild, the stadium goes like hushed, dead quiet, and the only thing anybody can hear is the sound of your 102 mile an hour fastball in the glove. I think that would be cool too. Like I think a string quartet would be another, like a live string quartet for like a very deranged sort of like Hannibal Lecter approach, I think you could, is stuff you could play with as a closer. Whereas as a hitter, you got like that 10 seconds, and like it doesn't even matter what the song is, you just need it to be a hook that everybody can everybody can recognize.
Yeah, the Red Sox before their home playoff games used to play this like long highlight reel video of like the Red Sox history, including a lot of like negative elements of their history before 2004. They set it to like the theme song from The Exorcist, which was just like always creepy. And it was something they had done like before they won the World Series. That was a video that they played to that song. And so that always struck me as something that would be like super weird to use as a reliever coming out of the bullpen to get the do 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 do
like yeah, that. I like that.
That music to it.
Although, a lot of 80s horror movies, like because like the Halloween theme that's like dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And like there's like songs from The Omen that are like religious terror themed that I think would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, my bullpen music I've always thought should be like Joker and the Thief by Wolf Mother, which I just like how that builds. And you know, I'm not like a metal guy, so I need to go with like, you know, a reasonable rock song that's not too hard.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too amped, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's a case to be made for getting too amped.
That was like before I played like basketball games as a kid, you know, everyone like listens to the hardcore music or rap or something to get them going. And I was like, I'm going to listen to some alternative rock. I'm going to put on some like Vertical Horizon or Bare Naked Ladies.
Oh, man. That is a very specific moment in time. Vertical Horizon went to my college a few years before I did. And when I was in a band in college, they were like, that was like the aspirational story of the Georgetown music scene. It was like, you too may someday be Vertical Horizon.
Oh, see, I thought you meant that they like played a concert at your college.
No.
Like,
they
yeah,
were.
Yeah, I don't think that's the only college Vertical Horizon has played at, Ted.
No, they did. I think in the entire 4 years I was there, I don't believe Vertical Horizon ever showed up. I'm not certain I would have gone or found out if they did. But, you know, we did get Wyclef for one of the worst concerts I've ever seen in my entire life. But that's a different story.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
We have a question and a good one, and it's about next year, and it's something when I saw it on Twitter from this is from Martin Kester on Twitter. It shook me awake because I totally forgot about this. He says, can you ask Tim Britton if anyone has a plan for Robinson Cano and the 2 years and $48 million left on his deal? Is he a part-time DH? Would Steve Cohen pay it off and release him? Where does this rank this winter with Stroman, Conforto, center field, and everything else? Adios and peace.
Yeah, so I think I don't know. I don't know that the Mets know at this point. It would be a lot easier for them to make an informed decision on this if they knew what the status of the DH was going to be, but they don't. It's $48 million, but the Mets are getting $7.5 million of that paid down by the Mariners. So for them, it's only $40.5 million. Right. Big difference. So I think, you know, the two options are pretty much what Martin laid out. It's either keep him and have him as a part-time player. I don't think you're handing him back his everyday second base job next year. And the DH, if you know you have the designated hitter, that's a pretty nice left-handed bat. You know, we can debate what you can reasonably expect out of Robinson Cano, because he was not very good in 2019, and he was very good in 2020. You can kind of, it's easy to forget that he had a 141 OPS plus last season. Mm-hmm. I certainly forgot that. You know, he tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs for the second time. That suggests that maybe he would not be as good when he comes back. So I don't think you're giving him his everyday second base job. You can contemplate giving him a part-time job where he helps you out and adds depth to your team. You know, not unlike what like Albert Pujols is doing for the Dodgers currently. The other option is just to eat the money and let him go. Like there are some fans who will say, like, can we trade him? Can we like attach a prospect to him? No, don't do that.
Yeah, no.
You are a big market team. You should be looking, like, if any other team has Robinson Cano and wants to attach a good prospect to him, you should be the team acquiring that guy.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a team that you pay down $30 million of the $40.5 million that wants him or something like that. I don't know that there's a team out there that fits that mold. So I think those are really the two options. It's keep him and play him part time, or just cut bait. I don't know how they feel about his personality in the clubhouse. I've heard kind of both sides of it. You know, there are People going back to his time with the Yankees who thought he was not a great influence in the clubhouse. I've also talked to several different players who have played with him who have called him like the most important mentor in their baseball careers. Guys like Ketel Marte and Gene Segura, who he played with in Seattle. So there's that part of it, whether you want him in the clubhouse or not, and how he would, as a veteran player, accept a limited role and a not everyday role, a guy who wants to get 2,000-3,000 hits and would like to be in the Hall of Fame, but probably has hurt that case.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't, there's no obvious thing here. I think it's just those two decisions, and it's harder because they're not going to know. Like, if they knew they had a DH and they said, okay, you know, our regular lineup that we run out there is going to have Pete Alonso as our regular DH, but, you know, and with Dom Smith playing first base, and, you know, we're going to mix it up a little bit. Sometimes Dom will be in left. We'll give JD Davis some DH time. We'll play Pete at first. And Cano can be part of that mix. That kind of makes sense for them. And also, if you have a DH, you can be more creative with your bench. Like, you can carry guys who do less because you're not pinch hitting as much. You're not double switching as much. You're not using your bench on as regular basis. So it's easier to carry, like, he's our left-handed pinch hitter. That's all he's going to do. I don't think they're going to know about a DH until close to spring training. You know, in the situation with Cano, they don't have to make a decision before then. Like, they can hold on to him the whole time. They have team control over him. I don't think it should impact their offseason plans, really, whether he's on the team or not. You're paying him. Like, he's part of the payroll regardless. You've got to think about that. But so they can probably afford to wait on that. But, it would be nicer to know in November if you're operating with the designated hitter or not.
I find, like, so much about Cano and his situation fascinating. People don't want to hear that word, I guess, for it, because there's so much still outrage over every time a guy takes steroids in baseball. But with Cano, it's so weird and baffling, or I don't know, to me, that, like, he never once got caught using steroids until after he already had a massive contract, and after he was already, like, more or less a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame. If he had just retired at that point instead of, like, you know, letting himself get caught, I think he would have made the Hall of Fame. Like, and now, you know, he almost certainly won't. It's a weird thing to think of it, because people tend to associate, they say, like, these guys are cheating the game by trying, they're doing this to, everybody always says, like, you're doing this to make more money. This is a greedy move. And clearly with Cano, it's something different than that. And to get yourself caught twice, then I think back to, like, Henry Mejia, where it's like, can you not stop? Like, are we talking about, like, I don't know. It's a huge and heavy topic for conversation, but it's like, is this something closer to addiction than cheating at some point? And I don't know the answer to that. But in terms of his position on the roster is another point I want to make, and something I want to make before, because I think this exposes how flawed Major League Baseball system of punishing steroids cheaters is. So if you're a member of the Mets front office right now, you should be, like, I hate to say this, you should be actively rooting for Robinson Cano to get on steroids or stay on steroids, right? Because it means that not only will you benefit from the juiced up Robinson Cano for as long as he stays on the field, but that as soon as he gets caught, you're off the hook for that bad contract. And so, like, I think that's a major, like, this, and this has been something I've been thinking about and saying since A-Rod's year in steroid suspension, because that was at that point an albatross contract that the Yankees were able to get out from under thanks to his suspension. It shouldn't be that way. Like, you need to make it so that the team is penalized more when its players get caught taking steroids, not that the team, because I think that if you put some of the accountability on the team, it might change a little bit. And right now, you can't logically say, like, oh, the Mets should want Robinson Cano, like, clean as a whistle and doing his best, when right there is the possibility of a guy who is going to be playing above what his, like, normal physical biological level should be, and then also who is risking taking himself off the Mets books when they shouldn't be wanting to pay him. So it's, you know, in this case, It's the Mets. It happens whenever an aging player gets suspended for using steroids, but it's a weird thing, and I feel like there's a solution involving, like, you got to come up with a way to penalize teams. So maybe you say, okay, that contract money goes to revenue sharing, or it goes to steroids education for youth programs, whatever you want to say. Like, I feel like you need to keep teams on the hook for that money.
Yeah, I actually, when you started that and you said you have a problem with the way they do it, I was hoping it was going to be that, because that's my problem with it, that the Mets benefited from the fact that they acquired and pay money to a player who had previously tested positive. And that, like, the best case, you know, when this happened in early November of last year, like, that was a good outcome for the Mets, that they lost this player for the 2021 season. Because they didn't have to pay him, and that didn't have to count against their payroll. If Robinson Cano were on the Mets now, or were playing and were not suspended, they'd be over the competitive balance tax threshold. They probably would have gone about their offseason in a different fashion. And so they have benefited from that in a way that I don't think any team should benefit from a player on that.
Possibly multiple times, right? If you're saying his 2020 was, and I don't know the extent to which steroids helped his 2020, but if you're saying that's what helped him, then you're saying the Mets, they win twice from Cano using steroids.
Yeah, they get the benefit of the improved performance and the benefit of him being suspended then, and they don't have to pay him. So yeah, I agree with you. I think that baseball still has a little bit of a ways to go in terms of making that. You know, we've seen it with some players who have had domestic violence suspensions, and the way that teams like commodify that, the Yankees being the classic example with Aroldis Chapman, and like trading for him when he had a depressed market because he didn't know about the suspension, and then dealing him away when that market had recovered, and then signing him back. Like, it's just an icky feeling all around when a team does that. Baseball, it would be nice if there were a way. As it'd be nice if Major League Baseball could close loopholes like that. It'd also be nice if you didn't have teams that hunted for like that kind of specific loophole.
For sure, right? It doesn't make most fans feel good, and it doesn't make the sport look good, and it's just not like a, I don't know, it's not pleasant. And you know, that's the least of the issues, right? Like it's worst. Obviously, it's worst for the victims, but it just sort of like ripple affects the distaste of it all to everyone.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say.
The Major League Baseball's got some issues on its hands. I don't know if you knew about that.
But let's talk about moving the mound back. No. I do not want to talk about that.
Mets are starting their fateful 15-game stretch. You won't be around to discuss most of it.
Yeah, so I am going on a vacation for the next couple of weeks. It is actually our honeymoon. We didn't initially plan for it to be during the season, but a couple of things kind of pushed it in this direction.
What could have happened in the past year and a half that would have sort of changed your plans?
Right. Yeah. I don't know what that was. But so it's the longest vacation I've ever taken in the middle of a baseball season. And I was when, you know, we decided to go forward with this trip at this time. I was kind of thinking like, oh, you know, the Mets they'll be in first. It might be a tight race, but I'll be back for like the most important part of the pennant race in the NL East. And, you know, they're playing the teams that are probably going to. Well, I knew Miami would be out of it. Washington, at the time we were planning it, was a part of the conversation in the NL East. I'll be able to cover the most important part of the season. And now it just looks like, you know, unless they really do run off a really nice stretch here, the way they did in like 2019 when they hit an easier part of their schedule, then I'm it's just kind of playing out the string at this point. And it's remarkable to me that in the span of 3.5 weeks, we've gone from a team comfortably in first place to a team in this spot.
And you bailing on it altogether. But I will remind you also, like, just be careful what you wish for, because when I went on my honeymoon in 2009, the Mets were not going to be in the postseason that year, and I didn't have to worry about missing that. But I did, when returning into the American airspace and American TV coverage, the first thing I saw on the in-flight television was Omar Minaya calling out Adam Rubin for reporting that Tony Bernazard had taken his shirt off and challenged a bunch of AA players to fights.
So, yeah, I mean, you never know. There is no safe time as a Mets beat reporter to take any vacation. There, you never know what's going to happen while you're gone. So hopefully, you know, we'll have Rustin Dodd is going to fill in for me on the writing side. I don't know what the podcast plan is. You probably know that better than I do. Hopefully he does not have to do anything too crazy.
Yes, we have a thorough plan, and I definitely know what it is. Tim, I hope you have a good time.
Me too. I really look forward to it being a good time.
Peace out.
Adios.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.